Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, it's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time. That means it's time for an episode of Stunt Treks with yours truly, Uncle Jim, and the one and only Leslie Hoffman. How you doing tonight, Leslie?
Oh, I'm doing okay. Wasn't sure if I was going to be here or not, but it worked out.
That's good. That's good to hear. But even if you couldn't be here, we can do the show from anywhere, so that works out good for everybody. We're not going to be talking about Planet of the Apes tonight, actually, and we're not even going to be talking about Star Trek Prime Directive, because Leslie texted me, was it yesterday or Friday? Friday, maybe. Oh, anyways, Leslie sent me a text and said that she had a friend who actually was a visual effects artist, and that she asked him if he would be willing to come on the show and talk with us, and of course, that was a great idea. So our phone number here is 646-668-2433, and if you have any questions for Matt Boardman, please give us a call. Matt has worked on some really great stuff that I think you're gonna recognize. He's worked on Star Trek Discovery, and you know we're going to talk about that. A Star Trek Continues, Star Trek Renegades, one of my favorites, Battlestar Galactica, Blood and Chrome, Defiance, which is a TV show I used to watch quite frequently, and, of course, The Orville. So if you'd like to have any questions for Matt about any of those shows, please give us a call, 646-668-2433. And he is currently working on a movie, which I'm really quite excited about because I remember going to see the original at the movie theaters way back in 1986. And I'm talking about Top Gun Maverick. And he's worked on that as well. So we're definitely going to squeeze in for some information about that movie. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Matt. Matt, how you doing tonight?
Well, you know, we're doing great. You know, trying to stay out of trouble. Doesn't always succeed.
That's the best you can ask for, staying out of trouble. So, you know, I'm looking here. I know Leslie said that she knows you. So how did you and Leslie meet each other, actually?
Well, oh, I don't know how long ago that was now. It's probably been it's been over 10 years, so probably maybe 12-ish.
That's what I was just thinking about that, too, is I don't know if we've known each other for 15 years or maybe not 20, but it's been a long time.
Well, as I remember it, back in 2005 when they canceled Star Trek Enterprise, I had, you know, obviously that was a little upsetting that they had canceled the series. And I remember that was sort of a launching period of a lot of Star Trek fan films. And one of those groups was the Star Trek New Voyages group. And And I remember being on their forums, on their website at the time, and seeing Leslie comment here and there, and I was like, oh, who is this person? So I clicked on her website, and I was like, oh, I have to help this poor lady with this website. And so I reached out to her and just said, hey, I like to build websites in my spare time. You know, would you be interested? And so that's kind of how that got started.
And
well,
the
other thing that I wanted to say is that a lot of people have dreams of going out to Los Angeles and pursuing a career, whether acting, stunts, visual effects, whatever, and you know, you were working on the fan films, but deep inside you, you really wanted to come out to Los Angeles and you know, work on how do I say, as opposed to a fan film, you wanted to work on professional films. And
right.
And I remember that we used to have a lot of talks about that leap of faith, you know, come out. And the worst is that, you know, it doesn't happen. The best is that it does happen. And you came out and you followed your dreams.
Yeah, it was, well, I remember there was one, well, how many times? I think I came out once or twice and you let me stay with you and took me around to some places. But I just remember coming out here for the time, and it's like, there have been a few instances in my life where, you know, something, you have something, you experience something, and you feel like that is what I was meant to do or where I was meant to be. And the first time coming out here, I just had this feeling that it was like, this is where I need to be. And so it's like, at that point it became, okay, what do I need to do to get out there? And at the time I wasn't sure, you know, the first couple of times I came out to visit, I just wasn't sure how that was going to happen. And then, you know, life has that way of opening doors for you that you don't expect. And that led to me, having an opportunity to come out here and work on a production out here. And so it's, I've been out here ever since.
Now, Matt, what exactly for the people that are listening, what exactly does a visual effects artist do on, say, a Battlestar Galactica, Blood and Chrome, or the Orville? What exactly would your job entail?
Oh, what don't we do? well, I mean, it's interesting because I talk to people and tell them I'm a visual effects artist, and they're like, well, what does that mean? And it's like, how do I sum this up into something short and concise so that people's eyes don't glaze over and they start to fall asleep while I'm explaining everything that we do? It's a wide variety of things. I think for most people, what they would recognize is the big CG scenes in movies, you know, more recently the Marvel movies or like Transformer movies or, you know, any Star Wars or anything like that, the spaceships and stuff like that. That's the most recognizable thing, I think, when people think about a visual effects artist, that they would notice. But we actually, beyond that, we do a lot of other things that people that are in films that you may not know about. Like, for example, I did the first half of the final season of Arrested Development on Netflix. And I did a lot of what's called invisible visual effects, where I actually combined scenes together to make it look like an actor was, you know, two scenes were filmed at the, you know, performances of actors were filmed at the same time. And they, you know, for example, the editor liked the performance of one actor in one take of the scene, and then they like everything else from a different take of the scene. And so I have to combine it together to make it look like it was filmed at the same time. Or sometimes you'll have, you know, a boom mic that drops down in, or markers on the floor and stuff like that, that they, you know, things don't line up. And so they those have to be painted out. So that's one of the other things that I, you know, visual effects artists can do. So it's a wide variety of things.
Well, since Leslie and I usually end up talking about Star Trek, let's dive right into Star Trek. I noticed that you worked on Star Trek Discovery, the Vulcan Hello, which was the pilot episode. Well, it's a two-part episode, but it was the pilot episode for Star Trek Discovery. And it says here that you were a renderer and a graphic artist on that. So what kind of, using that as an example, what kind of work did you do on that Star Trek Discovery episode?
Well, if you notice, it says I'm uncredited, and that's because, unfortunately, we were part of an in-house visual effects team that eventually decisions were made that they wanted to go to a more traditional vendor route. So they unfortunately let us go. We worked for about 6 months on that series. We did a trailer for Comic-Con, which was it was received with mixed reviews, but we also had we had 2 weeks to work on this thing. We were asked to put together a trailer for Comic-Con, and unfortunately 2 weeks was not wasn't quite enough time to do something that would be up to our professional standards, the standards that we would have liked to, but you know, needless to say, we did that. And then we were in the process of putting together an office and getting the ships and other things ready for the first episode there. And unfortunately, a decision was made that they were going to go with different vendors. So thus ended my short experience on Discovery. But it was great though. I got to read some scripts and see how, you know, and it's interesting to see how things translated from the scripts that I read to what actually ended up in the first season there.
So in that particular episode, what kind of things were you working on in that episode before they went in a different direction?
Well, I mean, we hadn't really done anything up to that point other than, you know, build some starships. We were doing tests. There were some things at one point, and I think they've actually shown some of these things at some of the Star Trek conventions. But initially, there was going to be a fully CG character on the bridge, you know, one of the bridge crew. He was going to be a tardigrade, which did show up in the series, just not in the way that they originally envisioned him. So we did some tests with that to see if that was possible. I think they've also shown some concept art. I just have to make sure that I'm not saying anything that's not out, you know, that's outside of my NDA, which is still in effect. But we had done some tests. Saru actually had a different design initially, and so he was actually intended to have multiple eyes. And so obviously, you know, Doug Jones, the fantastic and wonderful Doug Jones, who plays that character, would have had to have worn this. I don't know if they were going to have him wear a prosthetic piece that was the shape of his head, or if we would have been adding that. We had some great character animators who did some initial tests of this, but he initially was planned to have six or eight eyes And then, you know, the two in the center would have been his own eyes, but then we would have, they would have had CG eyes for the rest of his head. And so, you know, and it's all things they test out and just to see how practical that is to do. And obviously things like that increase the budget. And so then they have to ask the question, well, is this practical for us to do in terms of a you know, our budget? And ultimately it was decided that, that they would go in a different direction with the makeup, which, you know, I think that the makeup that they landed on is fantastic because it, you get more of Doug Jones and his performance in there that rather than a CG performance.
Well, I think that's just, I think that's exciting that you got to be there right from the beginning. You know, when it started, you got to see where it started and what actually ended up on the screen. I think that's exciting. So let's move. Okay, so let's move into some other Star Trek projects I see that you've worked on. These are what are referred to as fan films. I noticed that you worked on quite a few episodes of Star Trek Continues here, and Star Trek Renegades. Star Trek Captain Pike. These are all Star Trek fan films. It says, Captain Pike, you were a visual effects supervisor. On Renegades, it says you were a visual effects artist. And Star Trek Continuous also says you were a visual effects artist. So what kind of work did you do for the fan project versus what you actually were doing for Discovery?
Well, I mean, the fan films is kind of where I got my start. You know, that's, I mean, back then, I think the first one that I actually worked on was Of Gods and Men. And you know, it was very basic. I mean, I was just learning. I was just starting out. And so, you know, some of the tasks that they would give me were as simple as, hey, can you just render out, you know, put this on your machine and render it for us? Because, you know, we didn't have access. You know, a lot of visual effects companies have render farms. Now they have companies who are actually dedicated to that, where they have machines that you can pay to use and have it render out your CG work. But back then, that wasn't an option, and so it was just us using our home computers. And so we would try to spread that around as much as we could. And, you know, I got to do a couple animations here and there, CG animations, for things like Star Trek Continues. I mean, I worked on every episode of that, and it ranged from, I did all the handheld phasers, and I did all of the transporter effects for that series. I had the opportunity to do a CG shot in the final episode where we're, you know, there's an establisher shot of San Francisco, and I had some shuttles coming through and everything. And then I'm trying to think of what else from that. Oh, I would say probably the most impressive thing that we were able to do is there is an episode called The White Iris, and in that particular episode they have Kirk on a holodeck, and he's kind of revisiting some of the women from his past, and it was all shot entirely on green screen. And at the time he had another artist that was supposed to have put together some of these green screens for him, and that artist just, I think, had other work obligations that prevented them from being able to do that. So Vic Mignogna and I sat down in a matter of 48 hours, a couple days, and we knocked out all these green screen shots in that episode. So, so you know, it's a wide variety of things, anywhere from, you know, CG animation to compositing, you know, putting people in front of, you know, people who are filmed in front of green screens and putting backgrounds back behind there, doing little effects like the phasers. And yeah, I think kind of been my experience. I did do some modeling, not like I was walking down the runway modeling, but some modeling of starships and sets on some of these as well. So it's kind of funny to go back and look at that stuff compared to where I am now as to where I was back then. And I look back then and I'm like, oh gosh, it's a little embarrassing, but you know, we all have to start somewhere, right?
Well, I personally think Star Trek Continues is a fantastic web series. I think Vic and his crew did a really good job of capturing the feel of Star Trek, and I think they're very well done, actually. I mean, obviously they're not Star Trek Discovery caliber, but they're really, really good.
Yes.
So,
well,
that's
the thing that I really appreciate. Yeah, I really appreciate Star Trek Continues because the storytelling feels right in there with what you would expect from the original series of Star Trek. You know, a lot of those episodes were sort of a morality play and holding a spotlight to societal issues. And I think that they captured that with a lot of their with their episodes. But outside of that, they were very they did a great job of capturing that aesthetic, from the sets to how we did the visual effects. Things could look a little modern, but they still wanted it to be grounded in what it would look like, with the abilities that they had back then. So, just a little bit of a twist of the screw there on the visual effects, but at the same time, wanting to capture that feel of the original series back in the 60s.
Now, how closely did you work with Vic on Star Trek Continues, or were you at a computer studio somewhere else and he was somewhere else? How did that work?
Oh, yeah, it was all done from home. Oftentimes it was just, Vic calling me up on the phone saying, hey, I've got these shots that I need your help with, or we've got a certain number of transporter shots. And the transporter shots, those are pretty standard fare. It's a matter of it's the same procedure and the timing and everything like that of getting the effect that washes over the character as they transport in and out. It was usually with Vic, it was a phone call kind of setting things up, and then he would check in periodically to see where I was at with things. The one particular episode, The White Iris, we actually were on a Skype call where I was sharing my screen with him so that he could see exactly and give me real time feedback on what he was seeing. And so that was a neat experience just because, I can't even tell you the number of shots, but it was quite a few shots. That we knocked out in just a short, consider, 2 days sounds like a lot of time, but in reality, it's a short amount of time, to do as many shots as we did. So that in and of itself was pretty impressive that we were able to do that. In talking with him on the final episode, he would share a few things with me here and there, and I had a couple of thoughts that sort of made it into, I think it was more or less, I was kind of thinking along the same lines that he was, and I said, hey, wouldn't it be great if we had this musical cue here or there? But typically, that as a visual effects artist, you don't quite have that that much level of input other than what you bring to the screen.
Matt, we have to take our first commercial break of the night. For you guys listening at Odyssey Radio, we'll be right back. We're talking with Matt Boardman. Our phone number here is 646-668-2433. When we come back, I'm going to be talking with Matt a little bit about one of my favorites of Battlestar Galactica, Blood and Chrome. We're also going to delve into Defiance a little bit and, of course, the Orville. So don't touch that dial. We'll be right back after this quick message.
Trek Talking, all things Star Trek and beyond. Thursday nights, 7:30 to 9:30, all hailing frequencies are open. iTunes, iHeart, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon, and wherever fine podcasts are found. Trek Talking, boldly going wherever your mind is willing to go.
And welcome back to Stunt Treks with Uncle Jim and D. Leslie Hoffman. We're talking with Matt Boardman, visual effects artist. Our phone number here, once again, is 646-668-2433. And Matt, back in 2004, the Sci-Fi Channel put out a reimagined version of Battlestar Galactica. They followed it up with a movie called The Plan and a short-lived TV series called Caprica. And then they put out Battlestar Galactica Blood and Chrome. And Battlestar Galactica Blood and Chrome is the one that I happen to like the best, that told the story about Commander Adama as a Viper pilot. Would you talk a little bit about Battlestar Galactica Blood and Chrome and what you did to make that show come to life?
Well, before it begins,
could
you explain rendering a film? Because I don't know if people think that you just press a button and it's done and over with. I don't think they realize that rendering a film could take hours.
Well, that's exactly what we do. We just press a button and walk away, right? No. So when we use the phrase rendering, that basically means that we have to go through and we set up the scene. One of my jobs was on that particular series was we had our CG artists and they would do the animating and the lighting and everything like that. And then they would then pass that file off to us and we would go through and make sure that all of the models being used were the approved models, the latest version of that model. We would then make sure that the lighting was correct, that there weren't any errors in it. And then we would separate it into passes. So it's much like how they would shoot practical models, where you have, when they would put it on a dolly track and they would go through the same sort of pass just with, they would do a key lighting pass where that, if we're talking about spaceships, it would be your sunlight. And then they would do what they call a fill light pass, which is a light that's not quite as bright, but comes from the opposite side, but fills up part of the model. And they would do, a matte pass, which was when they would turn off all the lights except for the backdrop so that they could then use that to optical print the model out from the background and put it behind a space background or whatever, or put on top of a space background. So, but the process of rendering is that once we have that all set up, then we have to tell the computer to write out each frame individually. And then, so in a sense, yeah, you press a button at that point and you kind of sit back, but each scene can take, it can take minutes to do, it can take hours to do, depending on how complex the scene is, whether there's a lot of reflections. Machines have gotten faster, processes have gotten faster, so things like reflections back then, they would up your render times and, you could go anywhere from 30 seconds a frame to 20 minutes a frame to an hour a frame, just depending on what the complexity of the shot was. And so that's where the benefit of having a render farm comes in, meaning you have multiple machines that their whole purpose is to just take a frame and write it out and create that file to be used.
So I don't know if that sounds more confusing or if that helps explain it.
Well, I just wanted to point out, like I say, is that when someone says, oh, I rendered, I'm rendering the film or I rendered a film, as you just said, maybe it takes a second. But then again, it could take hours to do what you need to do.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember reading in a magazine back around the time that, Star Wars Episode III came out, and I forget exactly who it was. Maybe it was Rick McCollum who was saying, was talking about the visual effects in that particular movie, and he mentioned that had they rendered out those that opening sequence where you're over a Coruscant there and the battle and everything, had somebody at home rendered that out by themselves, it would have taken months, if not maybe a year or a year. It would have taken a really, really, really long time for somebody to do on a single computer. Because, if you think about it, if you have 10 frames that you want, or if you have 100 frames that you're rendering out and each one takes 10 minutes to render, that's a fair amount of time to render that out. It all adds up. And, you find ways to make things render faster, to shorten that that time and still retain good quality, because obviously the lower you set your settings, you risk lowering the quality of what you're working on, or what you're the image that you're producing. It definitely can be a lengthy process, and that's why sometimes when you watch a show or a movie, you might catch some visual effects that aren't quite up to the same look, feel, standard, polish as some of the others. And typically what happens there is that a request for a change is made last minute before delivery, and there's just not enough time to render out, to have the computers write out those files and have somebody combine them all back together and make it look nice and integrated before the deadline.
Right.
Wow.
That sounds like a lot of work. Interrupt Jim. Before we run out of time, we're halfway through or more than halfway through. Personally, I'd love to hear what you did with Next Generation.
Well, that was actually a really, really fun experience for me because, I grew up watching Next Generation. My first introduction to Star Trek was the animated series back in the 80s when they would play the reruns on Nickelodeon. And I don't think I was, back then, I don't think I was really aware of what I was watching. Just that I thought that it was neat. And then I remember probably was 87 when the first season of Next Gen was airing. I happened to be down at my grandparents' house, and my uncle, who's only a few years older than me, happened to be watching Star Trek, and it was the episode Skin of Evil, which is the episode where Tasha Yar dies, and that was my first Next Generation episode. And then, I had no idea what this show was, but then we went on a skiing trip with Cub Scouts later that year, and we were staying at our Cubmaster's house that he grew up in, and they happened to have Star Trek on, and it was the episode, I don't know if you want to call it controversial episode, but it's the episode where they blow up the guy's head, and just thinking how cool that was, but then I didn't come back to it until a few years later when they were about in the end of the fourth season, fifth season. But to me, Next Generation has always been kind of that like warm blanket. It was one of those things that when I was sick, I'm sure you guys remember Columbia House And when they started doing their next generation videos, they, you know, they, you get a new videotape every, what was it, 6 to 8 weeks, and it had two episodes on it. And when I was in high school and I was sick, I would my parents would put their VCR TV VCR combo down in my room, and I would watch these episodes over and over. And so getting the chance to work on this was a dream come true. I mean, getting a chance to see the dailies, and for those who aren't familiar with dailies, that's the stuff that was filmed on a particular day that then goes to editorial, and then they pick and choose from those things that were filmed to combine into what ends up being the final episode. But the chance to see some of that and to see some of the bloopers and stuff like that was great. I actually at one point had an opportunity. There's an episode in the second season called A Matter of Honor, and they reused footage of the Klingon Bird of Prey from Star Trek III. And so I got to go into a booth, and we were reviewing these visual effects shots from Star Trek III of Bird of Prey, trying to find this particular one that was used in the episode. And so that was a lot of fun. But I don't know, to me it was kind of like, it was a dream come true. It was my second job out in Los Angeles that I had the opportunity to work on. And I, you know, at one point I'm sitting there and I'm looking, and here's Doug Drexler, who, you know, obviously has a very long Star Trek history. Sitting there with Doug Drexler, a gentleman by the name of David Takamura, who started off on The Next Generation as, I think he started off as a page on it, and then eventually worked his way up to being a visual effects coordinator on Deep Space Nine. And so I'm sitting there with him, and then Mike and Denise Okuda come in, and then there's Dan Curry. So there's, you know, I'm, you know, as a fan, I'm sitting there and I'm going, oh my gosh, these are all the people that helped make Star Trek Star Trek, you know. And that was a lot of fun.
Oh, you're working with the cream of the crop. You've just named,
yes,
all.
Exactly. I mean, oh yeah, exactly. You know, it's so interesting when you start working with people whose names you've seen in the credits of shows that you've enjoyed, you know. And it's just, you know, it's just, I don't know, you just feel very blessed. You feel very fortunate to have that experience. And to be able to work on something that, you know, is important and has been near and dear to your heart for most of your life, makes it even that much more special.
And Matt, if somebody was interested in getting into that, how would you recommend they go about getting into that?
Well, I mean, for myself, how I got into this, I used to play this. I know I'm going to totally call myself out here on how big of a nerd I am, but I used to, back in high school, I started playing this Star Trek play-by-email game. And in this game, you know, the way that it worked is you created a character, and they had this, and it was back in the days of AOL, and they had these forums and websites that you could go and you could join a crew of a ship. And it was basically a bunch of people who got together to play this game. You created a character and you wrote from your character's perspective through email and contributed to the overall story. And as time went on, like, I kind of, you know, I started my own ship. I was given that opportunity, and we would build our own websites. And I would start, I don't know, it was one of those things that it just made sense to my brain. Like, I just had a lot of fun putting together these images as like episode titles. And then somebody said, well, you know, I see you like this stuff, so why don't you try this out? You might really like it. And what they sent me a copy of a program called 3D Studio Max 4. And suddenly that just opened up a whole new world for me. It was like, you know, there were all these different digital models that I could download online, and I was taking them and positioning them in to make these images and learning how to light them. And I liked it so much that I was like, you know what, I really want to learn how to do this. And so I bought a newer version of the program and a book, and I taught myself how to learn it. And from there, I in a way, I kind of lucked into this, because when I set out, I didn't really intend to be a visual effects artist. You know, I'd seen the Pixar movies, and I thought, well, you know, that would be really cool to be an animator on a Pixar feature. And so I kind of thought maybe that's what I was initially going to do. And so I went to school for 4 years, got a degree in media arts and animation. And then, you know, it's funny because I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do after that. But I would say for anybody looking to, like, get into this, the best thing to do is and this is what ended up happening to me, is that you engage with people who do that for a living. Well, I would say all of the jobs that I've gotten out here since I've come to Hollywood have been through word of mouth and showing people my work and interacting with people so that, you know, they're like, well, hey, we need somebody to do this. Would you be interested? And so I would say that if you want to get into the, you know, into a visual effects field, you don't necessarily have to go to school, because I've worked with a lot of people who didn't go to school for this, but I would just say, put yourself out there, put your artwork out there, participate in groups, get to know people who are doing this sort of thing. I mean, the way that I ended up getting an invitation to work on Blood and Chrome, which was my first production out in Hollywood, was that Doug Drexler had started a blog, and at the time I didn't have anybody that I was, you know, in immediate contact with who did visual effects. And so I would start showing people my CG work, and they would be kind of like, yeah, all right, you know, it looks okay, whatever. I don't understand it, but that's cool. And so I wasn't aware of the forums and stuff like that of people online that were doing these kinds of things. And so when Doug's blog came along, I just reached out to him, and I said, hey, Doug, how does somebody get in contact with you outside of your blog? And within 5 minutes, he had emailed me and said, hey, Matt, Doug Drexler, what can I do for you? And so I just said, hey, look, I don't have anybody to talk to about CG or anything like that, and I'm just wondering, can I send a few things to you? And, I mean, I don't expect you to tell me how to do them, but maybe just kind of point me in a direction so that I can figure them out. And so that – As time went on, like, he would write stories on his blog, and it would inspire me to create something, and I would send it to him, and he'd end up posting it on his blog or, you know, using something on his blog. And so at the time that they started doing Blood and Chrome, when they first got started, they needed a render assistant, and he sent me an email saying, hey, we're in need of a render assistant. Would you be interested in coming up to Los Angeles? You know, at the time I was living in Michigan, so that was a pretty big jump. And, but I would just say, yeah, put yourself out there, put your artwork out there. Never settle. Never think that your stuff is so good that there's never room for improvement. Be willing to accept critiques of your work, and understand that, you know, the difference between a genuine critique and somebody's opinion, and be an active participant with people who do this stuff for a living, because you never know when they will, you know, you'll get that opportunity that they'll invite you to do something. And the other thing I would say is, don't be afraid to take a risk. Don't be afraid to take that jump or that leap when the opportunity is given to you, because I've seen a lot of talented people who I think would do very well as a visual effects artist professionally, but they don't, because they're afraid, because they're established in where they're at and stuff like that. And I can't blame them, because you know, I'm a freelance artist, and there definitely has not been a whole lot of job security in that sense, because you go from project to project, and you can have gaps between projects unless you happen to work for one of the visual effects houses out here, and then it's more like a 9-to-5 job. But yeah, just don't be afraid to take those risks.
Wow, that's good advice. Very good advice. I just wanted to ask you, what can you tell us about Top Gun Maverick, if anything at all? What kind of stuff are you working? What kind
Not
of stuff are you
lot,
working
other
on?
Other than it is fantastic. Not a whole lot other than that. It is a fantastic movie. I'm so bummed that they've moved it back to November. I was really hoping that we were going to be in a place that we could, you know, everybody was going to get to see it on July 2nd this year after it got pushed back already a couple times. What a wonderful experience that was. Like, when I came out here, when I started on Blood and Chrome, I got to work with the wonderful Gary Hutzel, who was a visual effects supervisor on Star Trek Next Generation, and then Deep Space Nine, and then went on to be the visual effects supervisor for Battlestar Galactica, or the reimagined Battlestar Galactica, and then Blood and Chrome, and then all those other series in between there. And Gary was fantastic, and I miss him dearly. I'm so sad that he's no longer with us, because Gary liked to push the envelope and things, and he was really big on the in-house team and selling us as a package deal on how to get good visual effects for a fraction of the budget that I think they spend a lot of times on some of these things. And so one of the things that was great about that, and I think I got a little spoiled, is that we were a big part of the process of making Blood and Chrome happen. You know, when I came out, or when the first time I saw a rough cut of the movie, I mean, it was all filmed in front of green screen. Every part of that was filmed on the same sound stage. And I think I counted it. I think we go to like 11 or 12 different environments, all filmed on the same sound stage. And, I had a hard time, like, I don't know, this doesn't make sense, because you couldn't see, there was no backgrounds. It was all green screen. You know, it was the acting and then green screen. I mean, this was the first time I'm like, I don't really quite comprehend what's going on. But little by little, as production went on, or post-production went on, and we started filling things in, I was like, oh, wow, this is really neat how this works. And so, and it was the same thing on Defiance. You know, we got to be an integral part of that process of developing what the world of Defiance looked. I mean, we were doing, as they call it, world building. And so other productions that I've gone on, when you work at a regular visual effects house, you're just a small part in that process. You know, that you do your portion of the work, you turn it over, and then it's on to the next project, which there's nothing wrong with it. That's great, but it's not quite the same as feeling like you're that integral part of the production process, like I had on Blood and Chrome and Defiance. And so on Top Gun Maverick, I had the honor to work with a couple of guys, you know, fantastically very talented guys who have had many years of experience doing visual effects. And we did the pre-vis, which is short for pre-visualization, meaning that we went in and digitally kind of plotted out what it was basically a digital storyboard, an animatic of what the jets would do. And it was great because we got to work with the director on what he wanted. We got to show him some ideas. Oh, you know, it was this great collaborative effort. You know, he would tell us what he wanted, and, you know, he'd come in and he'd watch and see what we did. He'd give us feedback, and we'd make those changes and then suggest a few things here and there. So and then they went up and they actually shot this, the stuff that we, you know, most of the stuff that we had done, they actually shot that with real jets, and that was, you know, and so to come back, and then we did what we call post-visualization. That process is, that's where they filmed everything they need to film, and now they're assembling the film and putting it together to, you know, working towards what it will look like in its final, the final version of it. And they, in that process, need to add some additional things that the visual effects company that's been hired to do the final visual effects will be doing. And so we kind of helped fill in the gaps there. But it was great because, you know, again, you're part of that whole process, and you feel like you're part of that creative process. And that's one of the things that I really, really found that I've enjoyed through all of this, is like seeing how everything comes together from pre-production to actual production, to seeing how each individual department works and how everybody kind of comes together as a team to make these films possible. And I don't know. I mean, Top Gun Maverick was my first feature film that I worked on. I'm now actually working on another feature film with the same director for Netflix, and just really enjoy, you know, Joe as a director. You know, he's done other films like Tron Legacy, Oblivion, Only the Brave. So he's done some really great projects, and just you kind of see, and you get that little bit of a window into their thought process and how they go about filmmaking and everything. And then to watch the parts come together that eventually make that final film. And for me, that's fantastic. And that's fun. And it's, you know, it's sure for me, it'd be sitting in a cubicle every day, you know, doing something else. And makes those moments where, you know, you're in between jobs. It makes things get a little scary. It makes those times worth it. But on Top Gun Maverick, that was such a fun experience. I mean, I look back at that and that was basically 2 years of my life working on that film and getting to see it in different iterations and to see that process was really, really fantastic. So I'm excited for everybody to see it when we finally get to see it. Hopefully November will hold and we'll be through enough of the pandemic that people will feel comfortable in the theater so that everybody else can share in this wonderful film that's been put together.
Well, Matt, believe it or not, we are out of time. I want to say thank you so much for spending some time with us and talking with us about all the fabulous projects that you've worked on. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. Oh, I haven't spoken to you in I don't know how many years now, but
it's been a while.
Every once in a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah.
So you're welcome.
Well,
thank you for having me on. It's been fun.
We'll have to have you back. We didn't really get to touch on the Orville all that much, and there's some other things that we can talk about. But so if you're available, maybe we'll have you back on at a future date when Top Gun Maverick comes out.
Oh, sure, yeah. You know me. I'm always happy to talk about things. So.
Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight, Matt. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Have a good night or good afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks. And, of course, Leslie, you know, it was great that you were able to put us in touch with Matt and make that happen. And, of course, we couldn't do Stunt Treks without the Leslie Hoffman. So thank you for hanging out with us tonight, Leslie.
Oh, it was always fun. And again, Matt has such an unusual job that people don't even realize exists. And without Matt, you wouldn't have the Star Trek episodes or the Orville episodes. I mean, you would have, how do I say it? You'd have holes missing, or you'd have the green screen and nothing behind the actors. As you said, it takes a team.
There is one thing I have to say tonight before we leave, Leslie, because we never do a show without talking about it, and that is Planet of the Apes. There we go.
I know. Well, Matt's going to have to, if they ever do another Planet of the Apes, Matt has to get a job on Planet of the Apes.
Absolutely.
Well, you can only go.
So, Stump Treks, on behalf of Stump Treks, I'm your Uncle Jim saying good night. Thank you for listening to us. We really appreciate you hanging out with us. And you can check me out on Thursday night on Trek Talking and Beyond with my Trek experts. We're going to be talking about Star Trek, Next Generation, the pilot episode, Encounter at Farpoint, and All Good Things. And with Don DeLancey making an appearance on Star Trek Picard Season 2, it's a great time to revisit those episodes. So check us out Thursday night at 7:30. Same bat time, same bat channel. And please head on over to the Leslie Hoffman Appreciation Organization Facebook page. If you have an idea for a future show or you just want to say hello, head on over there and say hello to Leslie. She'd love to hear from you. So once again, thanks for joining us tonight. Stay safe, everybody. Be good to each other. We'll see you next week. Hailing frequencies are closed. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Let's see what's out there.